Welcome into another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I've got the legend, Brian Snow, on the line, and joining us is a familiar name to Xavier fans, a former assistant coach and former associate head coach at DePaul, and now the co-founder of an app who basically snitches on kids for not going to class, Rick Carter. How are you, sir?
I'm a legend, too, I think. I know B. Snow's a legend, but I think I got my own legend status.
Well, you have
Let's calm down. Calm down.
We take requested prefixes, but you have to request it ahead of time.
Hey, you know what? It's an honor and a privilege to be on with both of you guys.
All right. Well, there was just a little bit going on in college basketball today. If you had your head under a rock and you didn't read anything or look at social media, basically the FBI revealed that it's been running a two-year investigation into illegal schemes of fraud and corruption throughout college basketball. 10 people were arrested and charged. 4 of them were assistant coaches. The other guys were agents and someone that's high up in Adidas, like their global marketing director or something like that. And so that's basically where we start this thing. And obviously the idea is the agents, the shoe companies push these kids to certain schools. But it's interesting because the company being named is Adidas. The assistant coaches that were arrested were from Nike schools, and we really have no idea how far-reaching this thing is going to be. Let's start here. It's obviously a big story, but how much do you think this will actually change things going forward, guys?
I'll start off by saying we're not getting rid of cheating. The only way to get rid of cheating is to stop keeping the score, and I don't see that happening anytime soon. However, how the cheating has been done, I see that changing because – up until this point, the only thing that entered into a coach's brain, and Rick, you can speak to this, is avoiding NCAA penalties. So how do you do that? You remove yourself one level and get an agent involved, get a financial advisor involved. So that way, it's cleaner money, and you're not really tied to it. Well, now they realize, I'd rather be fired than have the FBI coming after me. So cheating will change, but cheating's not going away.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, I think all of it's based around relationships in recruiting in general. Your relationship with that family, now it's being unveiled, relationship with agents. You know, I think what this really kind of pulls the curtain back from is like people were jumping in the mud but not getting dirty. Well, in all actuality, they were still getting dirty when they were jumping in the mud.
That was deep.
You like that? That was pretty good, right?
From the coaching perspective, I think you would have the best idea of this, Rick. How rampant was this? Like, did you feel this every time you were recruiting a kid? Like, oh, it's going to be tough because so-and-so is involved and they're going to be cheating. Or was this something where you really have no idea? Some people might be doing it, some might not, and it's tough to really know who's doing it.
I think it was becoming clearer and clearer as I got deeper and deeper in the profession, like where it was going on. And I think, you know, there was just certain people that you knew when you recruited against them, you just might as well stop because you weren't going to win that recruiting battle. And, you know, the one thing I will say about all of this, a lot of these people I know very, very well, and they're good people. They're not bad individuals. Were they given things to be able to help manipulate a situation? Probably so. But a lot of times these families are the first people to ask for this as well, too. So let's not just pin the blame 100% on the coaches or 100% on the agents. Like, the kids' families have something to do with this as well, too.
This is obviously a bit different of a situation because we're talking about $100,000, $150,000 just in 2 specific reports that we saw today. Who knows how much is really out there? But there's different levels of cheating, right? And I think, you know, fans want to talk about, oh, we run a clean program and we would never do this stuff. But it's interesting, like, where do you draw the line on that cheating stuff? Because is it cheating to be paying for a kid's family to come watch them play in their conference tournament? I mean, technically, that's against the NCAA rules, but at the same time, I think a lot of fans would say, well, I'd like for that to happen. I'd like for a kid's family to get to see them. The NCAA should be paying for that, and since they're not, you know, things of that nature that the rules have changed different times in NCAA history, some of those things were against the rules that have been done, and I don't think everyone would be against them. So it's interesting to see where some people draw the line, and Rick, maybe you can speak to sort of the different levels of cheating. It's not all black and white, right? Like, there's are different things that different schools are doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best point to that is that the NCAA isn't the one who busted these schools or these coaches for doing this. the FBI had to get involved, right? Like, those are the people that had to tap phones. They're the ones who had to figure all this out. I mean, guys, the NCAA has known things of this nature have been going on for an extremely long time. I mean, this isn't a new thing. This isn't something that just started 2 years ago. Like, it's been a known thing in this business that that's a way to help get players. So it took them to do it. The NCAA has kind of turned a blind eye to it or just not been able to get the resources to get the information they needed to get these people in trouble.
You know, Rick, I would definitely say I think it's more the latter on that. As everyone knows, I live in Indianapolis. The NCAA is headquartered in Indianapolis. A few times a year, I meet with the NCAA. They ask me about situations such as this. They know what's going on, but trying to prove what's going on is a totally different ballgame when you have the limited power that they have.
100%. And they don't have the power of a subpoena. So they can't go in and they can get your phone records from the school. But again, like, people who are doing this, they know their way around this industry. They know how to get by. So I do think this is going to kind of uncover a lot of it. I think this is the tip of the iceberg. I think there's a lot more to follow, and I don't think it's going to be a very good thing for college basketball.
Do you think it drastically changes the landscape in any way, or do you think this is more of a thing where it's a huge story, it lingers for a long time, maybe a couple programs or coaches take the fall for it, and then we all just kind of move on?
The blue blood schools are going to remain the blue blood schools. What you might see is, you know, Auburn's been mentioned, so we can use Auburn as an example. Like, they've been recruiting at an unprecedented level. I don't think it's all due to Chuck Person and buying players. I genuinely do not. I think there's more to it than that, but it's probably a major factor. Might we see Auburn go back to being Auburn? Yeah, but the top schools are going to remain the top schools.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
Let's go to the Louisville situation specifically. Before we get into the Patino thing and whether he'll stay or go, will the NCAA take drastic actions against Louisville in some type of timely manner, unlike the NCAA investigation on North Carolina?
Keep in mind, some of that's out of the NCAA's control. There's a process that has to be gone through, and there's literally like 90 days to respond, 60 days to respond to the response. The way it's set up, they can't just, like, throw a gavel down and say death penalty. Like, it's just not it's not possible.
Well, and I think what's going to be interesting, just being in the situation that I was at Missouri when everything came down with Coach Haith and the NCAA and what was going on at Miami, you know, I remember meeting with the athletic director, I remember meeting with Coach, and it isn't like Brian's saying, it's not one of those things where the athletic director is going to walk into Rick Pitino's office tomorrow and say, you're fired. You know, all those things have to be thoroughly vetted before they can do anything to cover everyone's ass, to be quite honest and be quite fair. So it will be a lot longer process than people probably want it to be or hope it's going to be. And that's the worst part about it for a program, by the way. Like, you'd much rather have them come in tomorrow and say you're fired and you can't. The worst part is going through 9, 12, 14 months of an investigation when you're trying to recruit and no one's coming to your school. Because they don't know if you're going to be there or not. That's the worst penalty you can get in all of this.
Well, I mean, you would think so, but it hasn't worked out too poorly for North Carolina.
Let's not act like they're recruiting at the level that every other blue blood is. They're not.
No, but what my point is they went to a couple title games while they were being investigated. So, like, I'm pretty sure they're glad they didn't get, you know, the postseason taken away from them in those years.
Yeah, and I also think that's different because, like, when you're talking, and again, this is crazy for me to say, when you're talking academic fraud compared to paying players the amount of money we're talking about here, that's a death penalty type situation. Academic fraud is, and again, I have a classroom checking app, so this is weird for me to say. I think there's a way you can kind of not say that it was right, but who was really at fault for that? Like, if you're Roy, you can't be in charge of a tutor. You can't oversee that. Now, you can oversee your assistant coaches, but you don't know what they're doing on the other side of campus every day. So I think it's different. Brian, would you agree or no?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think what a lot of people don't know, and I don't know, Rick, you would know the specific rules necessary to Xavier, but at a lot of schools, coaches cannot direct, they are prohibited from directly even contacting professors to find out, like, even as simple as you can't find out when the test is. You're not allowed to see if that kid's behind in his work. You can't contact them at all. So there's a huge separation in that regard.
That's every school. That's every school I've ever worked at. You're not allowed to meet with professors, email professors. That has to come through the academic, the AAA staff at that university. Now, you have a relationship with them. They're giving you information, but it's not like you're reaching out to – that's very, very frowned upon in this profession.
So the Louisville thing specifically, regardless of how long it takes, what do you think ends up happening? Do you think they get some type of death penalty, or is it going to be much less than most people are thinking?
I think the death penalty is going to – assuming what's in the indictments is accurate, and I think, Rick, what is it, the federal, in a situation like this, like a 99% conviction rate, something like that?
It's 99.8% since 2015 is what the FBI has in a conviction rate.
So I'd say we can pretty much say what's in there is probably true.
Well, I mean, they have video of it, so tough to refute that.
So assuming that, and I want to make it clear, a lot of people think like North Carolina should get the death penalty. North Carolina can't get the death penalty. The death penalty is the repeat violators clause. You can only get the death penalty when you're already on probation. Well, Louisville's on probation. So they are one of the few schools we've ever seen that would even be eligible for the death penalty. I still have a hard time believing we're ever going to see the death penalty again, but I think it's going to be darn close, assuming that this is accurate.
Yeah, I think it's so early to tell just on the Louisville situation because there's just not a lot of information that has been given out yet. Like today, I think Auburn, I think there's other schools that were named today that you know for sure on. The one thing I'll say about Rick Pitino is he obviously has some great lawyers. Like he's gotten through a lot of stuff in his time, and a lot of it has just been based on things that he just doesn't know about, like claims he doesn't know about. And I think obviously that'll be another situation here. Do I think he lasts at Louisville? I mean, I find it hard to believe that he would if this ends up coming out being true. I think it'd be really hard to survive this one.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can do the I didn't know about it with the prostitutes thing, but then when you stand up and say, I'm taking the blame for that, I'm going to make sure nothing like that happens again, and within a month, you're caught on tapes saying we got to be low-key about this because we're on probation while, you know, making a $100,000 exchange for a recruit – that would seem like a tough sell for me if I'm Rick Pitino. At some point, it's just got to be, look, you can't control the people that are working for you at all, and you've got to be gone. So I'd be shocked if he's still the coach. But like you said, he's been able to get through some things. So if anyone can do it, it's going to be the Teflon Don Rick Pitino.
It's hard to be known as a person who micromanages your staff and micromanages your program down to everything, but then not know if stuff like this goes on. And I don't mean that just about Rick Pitino. You can throw that out there about a lot of head coaches in the country. They micromanage. That's what they're supposed to do. They're CEOs of a company. You know, so like at the end of the day, especially when it's coming from a shoe company, you would have to think that you know something's going on, or at least you better.
And I do think I can easily, especially knowing how it works at Louisville, easily see the scenario. And I actually agree with, I don't think Rick knew about it. One, because he's the least approachable head coach in college basketball for his staff. And then two, Rick Pitino is not low rent. If he was getting hookers, they're not going to be the street strange from the barbershop. They're going to be flown in from Vegas or Miami. That's just how Rick does business. But when you start talking about money from a shoe company, it is the head coach that has the relationship with the shoe company roughly 99% of the time, especially when it's Adidas and your staff is made up entirely of non-Adidas people. So that's a much tougher sell to me than not knowing about hookers.
That's
I get
a really
the hookers
point.
Thing. I don't get the Adidas thing.
Beast, no, that's a great point. That's a really, really, really good point. He is truly the only person on his staff that is tied to Adidas.
Bang. Nice one, Snow. I like it. Do you guys think in any way this is moving closer to us paying players, or do you think it has no effect on any of that?
I think it could. I don't want to jump to too many conclusions, but I absolutely think it could, because clearly it proves a market value, if nothing else.
I think the hardest thing about paying players is that it opens up labor laws that the NCAA and colleges can't really enforce. So, like, you can't stop someone from making an honest living. It's against the law. So eligibility goes out the window. If a person goes to the NBA and doesn't make it and they want to come back and play and a school doesn't let them because their eligibility is gone, you're stopping someone from being able to make a living off their craft. That's the biggest holdup in paying players. There's no way of getting around that. You can't have a 38-year-old come back and continue to play at Louisville because he didn't make it in the NBA or whatnot. So when they figure that out, they'll find a way to be able to pay them. But until then, they're kind of stuck where they're at.
Is that the same way with moving to some type of Olympic model where kids are able to cash in on their likeness or by having a YouTube channel or by doing commercials or something like that?
I don't know. I don't think that's the same. I think that's fine because you just say that doesn't make you, you're still an amateur by doing that. You know, like the person that I think it really has this somewhat figured out, and I can't believe I'm saying this.
LaMelo Ball.
It's LeVar. Well, LeVar does.
Yeah, like, exactly.
He's really throwing this thing out there and he gets it. Like he's challenged the NCAA to the nth degree. He's going to make them make a decision about LaMelo because of the shoe. And it's really going to kind of push things to the forefront because I do think it's a good model. I think he's kind of figured it out.
And that's the thing I've always said makes the most sense to me. It's like, yeah, that'll still help the biggest schools, and perhaps it'll shift some power because schools in the biggest markets might see a little increase if that's the case because, you know, you can get a little more endorsement dollars that way. But I've always thought that's the most fair way to pay these kids what they're owed, you know, because there's a lot of kids that really don't have any market value that are there for a free scholarship, and that's fine. But the guys that could be making millions of dollars and are making millions of dollars, and in some cases billions of dollars for the NCAA, they should be able to get a cut of the pie, and I think that's the fairest way to do it.
One thing I will say is I actually disagree. I think it's the schools in smaller markets that would benefit, because at the end of the day, who's getting a deal with LaRose's?
Well, that's true.
Trayvon Blewett or AJ Green?
No, you're right. I mean, that's a great point. The small towns with big colleges would kill because of this. I mean, yeah, Louisville is a great example.
I mean, yeah, I think it would all come down to your head coaches. It's their relationships. Who do they have relationships that are willing to endorse this kid, endorse that? You know, it'd be, honestly, it would just open up a whole nother bag of worms. Like, but if you make it legal, everyone has to work, meaning like the coaches have to work, the universities have to work to be able to provide that.
Do you guys think the NCAA was any way able to influence the FBI to help them with this? Or, like, what's the real reason
Hell
the FBI
no.
cared?
Hell
Do you
no.
think that it was just convenient once they had the dude on the SEC fraud charges?
This isn't about cleaning up college basketball. The NCAA or the FBI...
Oh, absolutely not. But that's my point. Why does the FBI care?
Because we're talking millions of untaxed dollars.
Exactly right. It's tax evasion. It's fraud. Like, and millions of dollars that are being exchanged for free. And obviously the government never wants that. Like, they want their money.
Like, legitimately, my grandfather wanted to give a gift to all of his grandchildren. And it was like, he was going to give us all, like, a large sum of money. And my dad stepped in and said, like, he said to his dad, like, you can't do that. They're going to get taxed on this. There's gift taxes involved. Brian Bowen's family got $100,000 of untaxed money. Uncle Sam wants his cut.
Well, but then that would seem to suggest that there's a ton more money out there somewhere that they're looking to cash in on, because if they've been running an investigation for 2 years, an FBI covert operation, you would think that's costing a lot of tax dollars, so you would have to have a lot of money out there to be able to make up for it.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, there's 10 sealed indictments as we speak, I believe.
That's what I was saying earlier. Like, I think what we saw today is really just the tip of the iceberg of what's really, really going to happen. There's a lot of people that aren't going to sleep very well tonight. Like, there's a lot of coaches out there that are going to lay down and not sleep good. Now, in fairness, there's also a lot of coaches tonight, guys, that are going to sleep great because now they actually have a fighting chance. They can out-recruit someone for at least a little while until someone else finds the next loophole.
Yeah, I have one high major assistant coach text me. He goes, I might suck at my job, but at least I know I don't have to worry about this.
Well, someone asked me on Twitter this exact question. What percent do you think are sweating tonight, and what percent do you think are laying happily on their pillows getting a good night's rest?
That's a tough question.
I mean, I think everyone in their own right, I know even me, I sat down today and thought about the conversations that I've had over the past 3 years. It's like, I think everyone does that in this profession today. You know, today's one of those days as a college basketball coach, you sit back and you really start analyzing who you're associated with and how that's going to affect your future, good, bad, or indifferent. So, I mean, if you want an exact person, I don't even, I couldn't even give you one. Who knows? I don't know.
I couldn't even guesstimate, honestly. Partly because, I always said there's, what, 351 schools? If the NCAA looks hard enough at all 351, they can find something that they're doing wrong.
Right.
But, you know, what percent are cheating with big money? Honestly, I don't know.
And I saw this on Twitter earlier. People are like, well, this can't be as much money as we're talking about with football. And, like, you know, football coaches and, like, what boosters donate for a football program, or donate's probably a bad word, but what they use to kind of get recruits in football. And what I would say is it's not, but it's different because that we what college coaches figured out is they went through agents, not boosters. You know, boosters are more for the football programs. So, like, I think to answer your question, I would say more than half are definitely not going to sleep very well.
And I think of that more than half, Rick, we should probably point out, it's more so because they're not worried about the feds, because what they've done isn't going to even be a blip on the feds' radar. It's they literally think the feds are trying to crack down on college basketball, which they're not. College coaches tend to live in a bubble where they're far more important than they really are. So they're thinking like, oh, I bought that kid's dad a tank of gas, so on this unofficial visit, are they going to come get me? No, they're not. You know, like, so I do think there's a heavy percentage of that as well.
I would totally agree. But what I would say, and this is what I am going to be interesting to follow. I'm not necessarily the FBI. I agree. I think the NCAA now really gets put in the spotlight of, okay, what are you now going to do about this? And not necessarily the people that were indicted, but it opens up this can of worms of, like, you really need to start investigating a little bit deeper on things. And it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. You know, because I do think there's more out there than just the $100,000 to this person's family. You know, like, what gets uncovered when they start, you know, digging a little bit, meaning the NCAA, not the FBI. Because the FBI doesn't care about stuff like giving someone $50 for gas, buying a kid a pair of shoes, a flight to the Big East tournament. Like, they don't care about that. They wanted to know about the $150,000 you didn't pay taxes on. Well, the NCAA does care about all those things. So when they start digging into this, that'll be interesting to see what happens from that point forward.
Yeah, I still wonder how much of that they'll be able to find.
Sure.
Does the FBI work with the NCAA on any of this at some point, do you think? Like, do they hand over some of the investigation and say, here, use this?
They can't do that for years.
Okay.
Like, this has to be all settled before they can do that. And keep in mind, the NCAA can't ask the FBI for anything. The FBI has to hand it all over. Per the, Rick, you might know this a little bit better, but per kind of the Frank Haith clause.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Like, they definitely can't. And the one thing I think the NCAA has learned is they definitely can't hire any of the attorneys that the federal government used and them use that information, because that just doesn't work, because they don't have the power of subpoena. But anything that becomes public record, you know, so like right now, the Louisville thing that's all coming out, like anything that becomes public record, the NCAA can then use and investigate on moving forward.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. What's the most interesting storyline for each of you guys that's coming out from all of this that we're not talking about, that no one's talking about right now?
I don't know that no one's talking about it, but for me, the most interesting thing is Sean Miller, Andy Enfield, Brad Underwood, even Mike Boynton, even though it's probably a little bit too early. The head coaches of these assistant coaches. How much of this is going to be ruled on their watch and how much isn't? And what exactly happens to those guys?
Rick, what about you?
I'm really interested to see what happens with the NCAA. Like, I'm really interested. Like, I think that's, to me, the storyline that I, obviously, for my profession, I'm going to follow more than anything else, is the next steps that they take. Because I do think they kind of get put under the microscope, like I said before.
All right, let's look at the potential impact immediately for Xavier here, Snow, since this is a Xavier podcast. And Rick, feel free to chime in or sit out on anything you don't feel comfortable talking about here. Snow, Sadiq Bey, it seemed like he was down to Miami and Xavier. Miami's getting caught up in all of this. He obviously hasn't committed yet. It seemed like he was going to commit any day now. What do you see happening with his recruitment at this point?
He certainly got a lot more to think about. I mean, I would be lying if I was assistant coach today at Xavier or Pittsburgh or, you know, even a Georgetown who had already been cut off his list. I'm going to lob a call in there and just be like, hey, Sadiq, there's only one private school in Florida with an enrollment of 16,000 people. It's Miami. You sure you want to risk it? And to me, if you're an assistant coach or a head coach and you don't do that, you're not doing your job.
With that being said, though, I do think as a head coach and an assistant coach of one of those schools, the other thing that you have to sit down and think about is it worth taking that person because they might not be able to play for you because they have accepted things? So do you start making other arrangements of like, well, wait a minute, if I take this kid's commitment and he is ineligible, now what am I going to do? Because that's the hardest thing about recruiting is when you get a kid, you obviously pass up on all these other guys that you need that position on your roster. So you really got to kind of dig in, and it comes back to relationships. Like, you have to know what went on before you can do that at this point, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, and let's make this specific to Sadiq. Rick, I know you never recruited him.
I didn't.
This kid's mom is the head of the D.C. public schools. You know, this is like a pretty straight up and down recruitment. It's the kid, his mom, gotcha. And the high school coach. I don't think anyone was really concerned at any point in time that it's an illegal benefits situation.
Snow.
Yeah, that,
go ahead. Sorry.
You're good.
Just in terms of potential decommitments elsewhere that could benefit Xavier, obviously they've got a lot of scholarships still to fill. Things were looking kind of bleak there here coming down towards signing day. I don't see any that necessarily stand out right now with the schools involved, but I think it's possible this investigation will implicate others, and who knows what might happen from there. You could see decommitments down the line, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think anything's possible. Hell, like, is a kid like Malik Williams going to be allowed to just leave right now? I don't know the answer to that question. And for anyone who knows, Malik Williams is at Louisville. He's currently enrolled as a freshman. Is that going to be allowed? Would a kid at USC be allowed to leave? You know, could it just be a grad transfer situation? Things I just do not know. I think the options are endless for any school and for what's going to happen, because we've never seen anything like this before.
Well, and Xavier is in a good spot in regards to taking guys like that, just because they're going to have multiple scholarships open probably throughout this entire school year. I mean, I don't think they're going to be filling all these scholarships in that amount of time.
Yeah, now one thing worth noting, the Ritter scholarship counts as a counter throughout the year, even though he's no longer enrolled.
Right.
So what do they have 10 guys on scholarship now, but they can only take two more no matter what.
Right, but even if you're looking at like 2018 recruits that could decommit down the line or something.
They have roughly 11 to give in 2018, I think.
Yeah, I think we're handing out at the next live Dana and Victory podcast at Dana's, we're giving away a scholarship there. They're going to let us donate one, so that's nice.
Hey, it's honestly, in college, it's a good thing to have scholarships, though. Like, don't get that twisted. So for all the Xavier fans out there that are over there panicking about, like, oh, my God, we're not going to be good in the future, I work for Chris Mack. You guys are going to be just fine, all right? Travis Steele, all those guys, Mike Pegues, Luke Murray, they're phenomenal recruiters. Don't worry about that. And having them available right now is probably the best thing you can have going for you.
Do you think, just from your perspective as a coach, do you think it's difficult to recruit after you take in a class that's ranked in the top eight? You have another young guy like Quentin Gooden who played 40 minutes a game in the NCAA tournament and Big East tournament last year, that's coming back as a sophomore. Having it look like you kind of have a set five in place for the next few years, does that make it more difficult to recruit a class later?
100%. It makes it more difficult because you're giving people things to recruit against you with. You're giving them ammunition. And it's hard when you're a high major program, but you don't have a lot of one and dones. So you can't fall back on, well, he's going to go pro. You know, like you really can't fall back and say that. You know, where like if you're a Carolina, if you're a Duke, it's not necessarily a hard thing to do because you have so much turnover on your roster. You know, if you're at the whole Big East level, really in general, the only way you're really having turnover like that after a year is because someone leaves, and then people use that against you. You know, like, why are they leaving? So, yes, definitely it makes it more difficult, and you have to plan for it.
Rick, I'm going to transition here, and I'm going to make an assumption. You had the Xavier scout last year?
I might have. Yeah, I did.
Okay. You saw them at three very different points in time. Right after Edmund got injured, as they lost six in a row, and then the very next week when it's like, okay, they finally won. What, when you were watching them, either during the game or in your prep, what did you notice different from kind of each time you saw them?
So one of my biggest complaints working for Chris Mack is that he was all about, we're a do-what-we-do program. We're not going to change. This is what we do all the time. Going into the games, I knew what they did, right? So it's easy to take advantage of things like that. What they did from the first game, they were just better, to be honest. Like, it was at Xavier. They were just a better team. It was a tough environment to play in. It was what it was. Like, we just weren't going to win that day. Chris Mack did the best job I have ever seen him do of making adjustments and getting away from doing what they do. And to me, that was the one thing we always talked about as friends, is that's what was stopping them from getting to a Final Four, is that over the course of that many games, six games in the tournament, you're going to run into a team where in the middle of a game, what you're doing isn't going to work. And you got to be able to make an adjustment to be able to win that game. And I remember sitting we were at Allstate, and it was like the third play of the game, and they had ran something different that I'd never seen before every time. And I'm like, we're screwed, because he did it. He's finally doing something different. And he put those guys in positions just to score. He put his players in positions to make plays. The one thing I'll say about Xavier, and anybody in the Big East could argue, I don't think a team has more talent. And now that Chris is kind of adjusting a little bit offensively, to go to that, they were next to impossible to beat, because who were you going to stop? You know, if you try to take away JP and Trayvon Blewett, if you try to take away Trayvon, you know, it went on and on. And then, obviously, Sean O'Mara throughout the tournament was just so different, you know. But that's what I would say they did more than anything. He just allowed himself to coach. And when he coaches, he is very good at it. You know, when he doesn't shackle himself with, I'm just going to do what we do, he's phenomenal, and he was great at the end of the year and for that point forward.
Do you think that stemmed at all just from seeing how switching to a zone on the defensive end worked at different times? Do you think that, like, kind of opened his mind at all?
So ironically enough, the reason we put in the 1-3-1 to begin with was we lost at DePaul because they ran an offense where all their bigs were spread out. And again, for novice fans, they might not get this, but we had a situation where bigs were partners. So wherever a big guy got the ball, another big guy had to close out on him if he was wide open. So long story short, we ended up going to a 1-3-1 zone, and it opened up his mind a little bit of, because he's the one who created the whole thing, the rules and everything, that you can do things other than what you're supposed to do to win a game. You know, and I definitely think learning how to switch defenses really helped him later on, now on the offensive end as well, too.
Then, Rick, a kid like Quentin Gooden, who you saw him kind of right after Edmund got injured, I believe. Yeah. How good do you think a kid like Quentin Gooden can be, considering what you saw from him at the end of the year?
Well, I think Quentin Gooden's biggest issue was confidence. He knew that if he missed a layup, someone was going in for him. He knew that if he didn't make a good decision, someone was going in for him. And again, this is nothing against Chris Mack. This is what every college coach in America does with a freshman. What happens when you get down to seven scholarship players is guys can make a mistake, and guess what? There's no one to go in for them. You know, so over time, they just get more confident. And as confidence builds, nothing matters to them. So I think Quentin has a chance of being phenomenal. Like, I was reading something the other day. I forget what site it was on Twitter, but people were talking about how Paul Scruggs is going to start. Guys, maybe I'm wrong. Quentin Gooden is going to be the starting point guard for Xavier. Paul Scruggs is probably going to come off the bench, right? And it just, that's what happens when you're a freshman. And now, does that mean he's going to come off the bench the whole year? No. He could easily earn his way onto the court by the time you get 5-10 games in. Maybe he's at a two. Maybe Quentin's at a two. But those kind of things happen because you're just not as confident. You don't know the system. I think Quinton's going to be phenomenal.
Just in terms of that NCAA tournament run you saw last year, was there anything else? I mean, it seemed, you know, just from the untrained eye watching that team, for whatever reason, they had three kids who you thought would have a huge year coming into last season in Trayvon, JP, and Edmund. For whatever reason, they never seemed to gel on the court together. Edmund gets injured. Obviously, Trayvon goes through his injury. But once he's back, it seemed like that offense finally clicked and those guys found each other. Was it more of what you're talking about with Chris Mack and his play calling and changing things up? Or did you see something out of like Trayvon and JP or other guys in that offense that also changed the dynamics and the way they played in the NCAA tournament?
Well, I think less is more sometimes as well. So having some guys that understand their role increases the guys' productivity that are your stars. When you have three guys that are trying to be the star in a college system, us as college coaches don't necessarily know how to deal with that, especially when you have equal opportunity offense, right? Like when you have a motion or a continuity where anybody can shoot at any time. When you get later on in the season and people identify their roles and they know where they're good, and again, they know they're not coming out, they're going to play for large stretches, so they're not trying to force. I think that makes everyone better.
Snow, you got anything else?
Seems pretty good to me.
All right, well, I'll wrap it up with one more uncomfortable question. Should Xavier fans be more afraid of Chris Mack leaving for Louisville or one of the assistant coaches getting caught up in all of this?
B-Snow, that's on you. I can answer. Like, I can go next. But go ahead, B-Snow. You got the first crack at this one.
I'll say Chris leaving for Louisville. And the reason I say that is because I know. I don't guess. I don't think. It's not a secret. I know Chris is genuinely really interested in that job. I can't tell you I know that an assistant coach has cheated or what he's done. So what I know would tell me the Louisville thing.
Knowing the assistant coaches like I know them, working with two of them, and I've known Luke Murray since I was an assistant at Fairfield because he was a student there when I was – he was a student when I was an assistant. I don't think Xavier fans have anything to worry about when it comes to any of their coaches getting caught up in this. What I would say is I would agree with Snow. I know Chris obviously very well. His dream job – or one of, his dream job is Xavier, obviously, because Cincinnati, that's where he's from. Christy being from Louisville makes that a very attractive job. I don't think you have to worry about either one because I don't think Chris Mack would take Louisville in lieu of what's a, if it does happen, the sanctions that come down on the university, there's no way you leave the job for that. It'd be different if you were at a lower Big East school and you're like, oh yeah, I might as well take this, ride it out for 3 years and then coach there for the next 10. He's in a position at Xavier, they've built it to what it is, that he has no reason to go and wait 3 years to be good again. And knowing him and his level of competitiveness, there's no way he can handle that. And, like, he knows that. So I don't think you have to worry about either one.
Wow. Great stuff from Rick Carter. Thank you for joining us.
Anytime, fellas. Hey, just quick plug. If any of these student-athletes aren't going to class, any college coach, reach out to me. Spotter, we'd love to take care of you.
There you go. For the legend, Brian Snow and Rick Carter, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.